Welcome to the Airplane Geeks, episode 173. I am not Max Flight. I'm actually Rob Mark from Jetwine. And that's because we wanted to give Max a little bit of a break, at least in the first 5 minutes of the show. And this week, I am joined by a couple of, well, at least one really great co-host and another one who just had to be here anyway. So let's start with the one who just had to be here anyway. Dan Webb. Dan, are you there?
Well, thank you for that glowing introduction, I think. Yes, I'm here. And good evening, Rob and David and Max. It's good to be back after taking last week off.
Well, and actually, I didn't want to make people think that Max isn't here because he is. And we're also joined by Max Flight from the 30,000 Feet blog. Hi, Max.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be here.
It is. It's nice to. Now, this is 2 weeks in a row we've had you back.
I know, but this time I'm just listening as a co-host while you open the show, so it's quite different.
I know. I think I can probably make it to the news, and that's probably when I'm going to burn out. So let's not forget our other co-host in beautiful Philly. David Vanderhoof, are you there?
I am here, Rob, yes.
That's wonderful. Well, you know, and tonight on episode 173, we're joined by Jamie Dotson, who, as I have come to know him, is the author of the Nick Grant Adventure Series. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. And Jamie has such an interesting bio. I mean, he's a kind of a Fed spy guy that's worked in a lot of really cool places in his life. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. I got to tell you, it's wonderful to be here in Airplane Geek Virtual World Headquarters.
Well, and you know, Jamie, you have a title right now that is longer than Max's and David and mine and Dan's put together. I just wanted to run this by everybody. It says that you're the Technology Protection Officer for the Security and Intelligence Division of the U.S. Army Aviation and Missile Research Development and Engineering Center Intelligence Division. Wow. Is that just one job?
Well, it's actually quite a few, Rob, but I'm reluctant to get into great detail because of security considerations.
Oh, I see, because then you'd have to come back and, yeah, I understand.
So well, I can do it from here, actually. We've got you zoned in.
So then actually this is going to be a secret show. No one will actually be able to listen to it more than once because it will self-destruct at the end, right?
Well, let me just say this. If it becomes a secret show, I will disappear and you will never see or hear from me again. No, I'm joking. Of course not.
Well, we're going to look forward to talking to Jamie about some of his adventures and also his new series, the Nick Grant Adventure Series, which is written for young adults. And being the parent of a 17-year-old daughter, I must say I was very impressed by it. I know David read another edition. So we're going to get to that a little bit later on. But I think we have some interesting news stories tonight. Perhaps we should get to the news. What do you guys think?
Sounds great. Okay, Rob, nice job on the opening. Let's start off with our first news story. This is from Aviation Week. Proposed rules for exports protect stealth. Well, the export of certain technologies are heavily regulated by the Commerce Department and the State Department. We have the Export Administration Regulations, or EAR, fondly called the EAR, and the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, or ITAR. And just for a little bit of background, the term export isn't limited to the physical movement of parts or material from the United States to another country. So, for example, if you have a Chinese national visiting your company and he looks at an airplane part covered by the regulations, then that is an export under the regulations. Now, the ITAR contains a United States munitions list, the USML, and that's of restricted articles and services. And according to this article, the Obama administration is proposing export control changes that would allow aircraft components to be more freely traded in the global market. And the article says, while continuing to protect parts designed specifically for the military's most stealthy aircraft. So this is kind of an interesting shift. And I don't know if this represents something really significant or not.
If I may jump in here, Max, actually, that's really one of the areas that I work in my day job. And I got to tell you that it's a move in the right direction, simply because the idea of basically saying it's military related, therefore prove to me that it shouldn't be on the list is, I think, not the best way to go about it. I mean, there's clear items that are on the military critical technology list or MCTO or the USML that obviously don't go anywhere. And there's a lot of export restricted items that we can and cannot export. And I'm talking about, you know, companies like Pratt & Whitney or Boeing or somebody else like that, sure. Raytheon in particular. But in general, what we're saying, what the Obama administration is doing is lightening the load on the people who, the companies and the corporations who can export excellent items which are really not militarily significant. So I think it's a breath of fresh air. And this is my business. This is what I do. I actually review much of the Army's in aviation and missiles release for ITAR and on the MCTO list. So for me, it represents, I think, a step forward without significantly reducing our desire to keep some of our most critical technologies out of hands. I mean, obviously, I think you and I both read the same article, but the radar absorbing material, the RAM material is not included. There are other aspects of not only the low observables or the very low observables, but also those types of devices, those types of sensors which we are developing, which can see those kinds of vehicles. So what I'm seeing, and I'm sorry I'm so long-winded about this, is a positive movement to release and reduce the amount of regulatory requirements without significantly reducing the security of that top of that very critical information.
Right.
So what kinds of materials would be on the open list now? What kinds of equipment will be more readily available, Jamie? Will you give us a couple of ideas?
I can. I mean, the things currently, what we've got to do is if you've got something like a Black Hawk that maybe looks a little different when you take a look at it or see some sketches on the internet, that Black Hawk, every single item on it has to go through the process for release. When clearly, in my mind, anyway, and again, I don't make the regulations, the landing gear, a lot of the common components, which are also in the UH-60 series, would be available for export were it not for these very, very tight MCTO-related and EAR and ITAR-related items.
So I think, very simple things. I mean, hydraulic pumps maybe generators or that sort of thing.
Yeah, electronics, interfaces. America still builds some of the absolute best human factors-related interfaces. We can convey more information to our pilots simpler than virtually anybody in the world. And I think that's a huge market that we can exploit, for the commercial side. And some of it's being held up because it's, you know, in these other types of airplanes, which we don't talk about on iPods.
And there really are a lot of countries out there, a lot of governments that really would like access to some of this technology. I mean, isn't that right, Jamie?
Yes, from my perspective, absolutely. But of course, those decisions are always made by the State Department. And what the Army does, and I'm only speaking from my limited perspective of one particular area in the Army, what the Army does is puts together what they think would be available and could be released to foreign entities. And, of course, you know, what you can sell, for example, to England and what you could sell to country X could be significantly different. But essentially, we make the recommendation, but state is the one that makes the call. You know, I'm surprised David hasn't jumped in on this. He knows so much.
I know, that's why I'm waiting for this. So, for example, David, when we saw the new Chinese fighter, we all observed and the press observed that the engine in that aircraft was I guess to be a Russian engine or something else. It wasn't really latest generation compared to what you see in this country. I mean, I think that's an example of the kind of technology that the Chinese, for example, would just love to have.
Part of this is we want our manufacturers in this time of low budgets and we're not buying as many. We would like to open the doors to sell things like F-35s to India. And we'd like Japan to do their own manufacture of that aircraft. And those kind of pathways we need to open up more so that our defense infrastructure doesn't go away because we're not purchasing as much. We need the infrastructure in place. And if by making the path easier, we might be able to sell more aircraft, therefore making all of us in a much better place. Now, we don't want to sell everything, but we do want to broaden the spectrum. And yes, if it means we can sell a bunch of fuel pumps that we wouldn't have been able to, that's a step in the right direction for our military infrastructure.
And reducing the costs associated with economies of scale is also critical. And I think David certainly alluded to that in his response. But, you know, if we're building 100, say, F-35s instead of 25, our per unit cost is going to dramatically drop.
Right. Okay, very good. Good discussion. Let's move on to the next story. This is from Bloomberg. Embraer plans engine upgrades over building bigger jet to take on Boeing. So there's been speculation in the press about what Embraer will do in light of the coming Bombardier C-Series and the single-aisle decisions at Airbus and Boeing. So now Embraer says that they will upgrade the E-170 and E-190 jets with new engines and wings rather than build larger new models to take on the offerings from Boeing and Airbus and Bombardier. And they see this as a big cost savings. Or really the avoidance of as much development costs. This upgrade strategy, they say, will cost $2 billion instead of the $3 billion it would cost for an all-new aircraft. So this is interesting. We've been waiting to see what Embraer would do.
Yes, we finally have some more clarity on the narrow-body market. And I think this move makes sense, because if Embraer were to go with a clean sheet design, not only would it be more expensive, but then also the story mentions how Embraer had been studying the market for planes with 130 to 160 seats. And if Embraer were to do that, I mean, I'm sure they would build a great airplane, but it's a much more crowded market.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously with the, now with the 737 MAX and the Neo.
Yeah. It would just be just too many competitors for, I mean, it's supposed to be a big market, but that's an awful lot of competitors for, you know, for that
right
pie.
And you have two competitors granted the engines are new, but with proven airframes and also very powerful companies that can probably have a lot of flexibility on pricing to help preserve market share and what have you. So I think this is certainly interesting. What I'm looking forward to following for the next E-Jet, at least here in the U.S., and this is sort of a topic we were talking about, at least I was talking about a couple weeks ago, is the E-Jet has done really well here in the U.S. as a regional aircraft for carriers like Delta, U.S. Airways, and United. And the question is, that flying is usually restricted by scope clauses in pilot contracts.
Yes.
So exactly how the whole scope thing develops over the next few years would affect, in my opinion, how many of these aircraft are potentially ordered one day, and also the mix of those aircraft. And the other question now is, now that Embraer has decided to more focus on its existing airframe, I guess it's sort of a good thing for Bombardier in the sense that it's one less competitor. But, you know, narrow body of market's going to be fun, because now we have the lines have been almost all drawn here, because we have 737 MAX, A320neo, whatever they're going to call the re-engine E-Jet, and the C-Series. So, and we'll be interesting to see how it all develops over the next few years.
Hey, Dan, don't you think that this is stagnating the airframers? If all we're going to be doing is re-engineering everything?
I think it's... I guess
interesting question.
You could call it... Max, feel free to jump in here, because you have more than knowledge than I do. I'm wondering if versus a clean sheet airliner, if we're looking just in terms of cost benefits, how much additional benefit you would see from a brand new fuselage. Because, you know, so I guess how much additional benefit in fuel burn, let's say, would a new fuselage bring in addition to the brand new engines? And I guess what brings the greatest benefit?
Yeah, I think the operators are demanding something now, or now meaning, you know, within the next 5 years or so. The airframers, when they look ahead towards, you know, what would a clean sheet of paper airplane do? I mean, there's greater benefits, but, you know, the market is demanding aircraft sooner than the airframers are going to be able to deliver in terms of a new airplane. And I think that's why why it seemed to take so long for, at least publicly, for Boeing and Airbus and so forth to declare what their strategy was going to be, because to a certain extent, I think everybody was waiting to see what everybody else did. And once Bombardier started with the C-Series, that kind of started the ball rolling. And then when Airbus made its decision on the Neo, that kind of forced all the rest of the hands to be shown, which points to a nearer term, you know, re-engining kind of strategy.
I mean, yeah. So nearer term, less expensive. But I'm still wondering, like, if Boeing had said, "Oh, we're doing clean sheet," you know, how much more efficient it would have been than, say, a Neo, if we had, in addition to like the Leap X, if you had a more efficient fuselage. I don't know if it's either design or if it's materials, you know, and how much would that benefit be, and would it be worth the extra few years of waiting?
Yeah, yeah.
But don't you think that the price of fuel, the rise in the price of fuel over the last, say, 24 months has really been another factor that has forced the airframers to say, look, we've got to come up with something now, and the engines that are there, they'd rather just work with that than even waste time trying to come up with a whole new clean sheet?
Well, I mean, with the engines they have now, these are still brand new, brand spanking new engines with new technologies. I'm not sure. I don't want to characterize it like, oh, well, let's use what we got. I mean, I think things like the GTF are still pretty dramatic technology shifts.
Oh, no. And I agree. I'm just saying that it seems to me like if you have to develop a new airplane along with a new engine, I mean, that certainly extends the time period before the airplane could be ready to fly.
Yeah, exactly.
At least that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Well, and let's slide into our next story, because actually it kind of relates. This is from the Chicago Tribune. United marks nation's first biofuel-powered commercial flight. And, you know, Rob, as you bring up, the airlines looking at rising fuel prices and how they're going to respond to that, going the biofuel route is one of those kinds of responses. So we see from this article that Continental Airlines became the first U.S. revenue passenger trip powered by an algae-based biofuel in this case. Also, we see that Alaska Airlines is planning to begin 75 passenger flights along with Horizon Air.
And Alaska did the first flight last week as well.
The first flight last week, okay. And they're using a biofuel blend made from recycled cooking oil.
Yes. I found a related article from Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
Sorry for the wild card there.
Go ahead, Dan.
I mean, this is great. I mean, it's good to see that the industry is moving forward with this. But paragraph from this Wall Street Journal article. Seattle-based Alaska Air Group, Inc., parent of Alaska Airlines, bought 28,000 gallons of biofuel at $17 per gallon.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah. What's jet fuel for airlines right now? Like three-ish, low threes, I think?
Yeah, a lot less.
Dan, I'll dovetail off that. When the Blue Angels did 2 days worth of biofuel demonstrations at Patuxent River this year, it cost more to do those two shows than it would have cost to do 15 shows with normal JP fuel.
Hmm. Look at that. David and I, for once, we're doing a commercial story, and it comes right together. That was beautiful.
For me, let me just chime in here again briefly. For me, I wonder about the economies of scale. Anytime we do a lot of prototyping and a lot of really out on the edge engineering and science in our areas. When we do the prototypes, they're phenomenally expensive. But when we get into economies of scale, we start really, cranking up a certain kind of technology. Those costs drop dramatically. Does anybody have any feel for, what the projections are for? I mean, clearly this biofuel is in the prototype stage. So does anybody have any projections for, whether or not it could actually be competitive with, jet fuel?
I don't know the exact timeline. You'd assume eventually
there's
that
some
production
crossover
ramp
point.
Up and, yeah. And you'd recognize those economies of scale. But I think, based on what some airlines look, the people are still trying to figure out exactly what the exact blend is the best and other factors like that. So I agree that, these really high prices will not remain. and they eventually will come down, but it's just going to take a while.
Well, in the article, we see that United has signed this letter of intent with this company, Solazyme. This is to buy 20 million gallons of biofuel, algae-derived biofuel annually, with delivery starting as early as 2014. So 20 million gallons, that's a much bigger number than what you quoted, Dan, earlier.
Give me a second.
When you start talking about 20 million gallons, I mean, that's still very small, I think, compared to the annual consumption of jet fuel by the airlines. But yeah, now we're starting to talk kind of serious numbers, it seems.
Yeah, according to I'm looking at United's 10Q here, and give me a second. So total fuel consumption for the 3 months ended September 30, 1.066 billion gallons.
Yeah, that's a lot of fuel.
Yeah, so I mean, we're getting there, and I don't mean to sound like a Debbie Downer, but it's just going to take a while, and so we will get there eventually, and that's the thing is, being green is great, and it's a totally very nice goal to work towards, but what's more important is becoming green on a sustainable basis, economically speaking.
Sure.
I think the key to what you said there, Dan, was sustainability. You know, can we sustain it for 1.06 billion gallons a year? Maybe we can, and I'm very optimistic that Americans do almost anything if they put their minds to it. I just wondered, and thank you for answering my question.
Yeah, but we don't know for certain that just because we can produce biofuel in huge quantities that the price is going to come down to the point where it's comparable to jet fuel. I mean, but we also have to factor in that, do we want to save the planet aspect, that discussion people are forcing us to do.
Sure, and I think our industry, the aviation industry, is seeing more and more pressure to act in a green manner. So in the end, yeah, I agree with Dan. I mean, it's going to come down to the economics of it, but there is this pressure to be responsible to our planet.
Oh, shucks. Hell no, we don't have to do that.
All right, our last article. This comes from aviationpros.com. Tarmac delays, an image problem for a Connecticut airport. Well, we had passengers on at least four planes stuck out on the tarmac for 7 hours at Connecticut's Bradley International Airport, my home airport, actually. And this was during the snow event that took out power in the state for something like 700,000 customers. But it's interesting. In the past, we've seen tarmac delays caused by actions or inactions of airlines. Do you guys think that's the same case here, or is this more an airport issue than an airline issue?
I think, and I'm going to disclaimer this and say that this is probably being investigated by DOT right now, and we'll get a very full, complete answer in the coming months. But there definitely appears to be some things outside JetBlue's control. So actually, this is according to their official company blog, and this is a blog post from a couple weeks ago. During the storm, multiple instrument failures occurred at JFK and Newark, affecting all carriers. This equipment is needed for flights to land with visibility low while it was out of service. Both airports stopped accepting arrivals, and eventually a number of flights had to divert elsewhere to get more fuel. And then, according to JetBlue for Hartford, the airport experienced intermittent power outages, which made refueling and jet bridge deplaning difficult. And they also said a temporary loss of de-icing capability added yet another challenge. So,
Dan, you located an interesting audio and transcript from that day, correct?
Yes, liveatc.net, and we had Dave on, year ago, I think. They were able to get the audio, and then also NYC Aviation transcribed it. So anyway, I clipped out one of the more interesting bits of it.
All right, here, let's listen to that.
JetBlue 504. JetBlue 504, go ahead. Look, we can't seem to get any help from our own company. I apologize for this, but is there any way you can get a tug and a tow bar out here to us and get us towed somewhere to a gate or something? I don't care. Take us anywhere.
JetBlue 504, roger. I will talk to state operations, see what they can do. Were you able to resolve the situation in the back, or is that still ongoing?
Yes, we've resolved it for now. We've got the show of authorities on board, but I have a paraplegic on board that needs to come off. I have a diabetic on here that's got an issue. It's a list of things. I just got to get some help.
Roger, do you need any paramedics or anything like that?
Well, we've got the fire truck over here, and I guess they have some medical background here. I'm not sure who all the players are back there in the back yet, but it looks like they've got it covered. My priority right now is a tug and a tow bar. If you just give me a welding shop, I'll be willing to make one myself.
JetBlue 504, Roger. I'll pass the message along.
Yeah, you can just sense a little frustration there, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So definitely airlines have to respond to these circumstances beyond their control, and these circumstances exist, but the question is, how do they respond to it? So the question is, did JetBlue respond effectively? And I'm sure they're looking at that internally, and now that we have this three-hour rule from the DOT, certainly there could be some kind of fine here eventually, if depending on the results of any potential investigations. So,
well, doesn't the airport get fined too?
No.
In this case, the airline's getting screwed. If the airport's not getting them back in, then we've got a real issue.
Yeah, and the tarmac fines are directed towards airlines currently, right?
Yes.
There's no...
Yeah, and actually JetBlue in their 10Q, which is a quarterly filing with the SEC, they said DOT is investigating these incidents and we may be subject to a penalty. So they popped that in there. So yeah, I mean, could there be a fine here? Yes. Will there be? Who knows? Depends on the circumstances.
You know, one interesting thing, I was listening to Scott McCartney from the Wall Street Journal. He does a little podcast, the Middle Seat podcast. And he looked at this and you know, he mentioned the same thing that you did, Dan, about there being some issues with landing systems at some of the New York airports. But he also said that he found that at Logan Airport, Boston's Logan Airport, there was a C-17 there with some wounded fighters from the Libyan activity. And that was taking up a lot of space. There was a lot of ambulances associated with that operation that was taking up a lot of space. And they also had an A380, that a Lufthansa flight that was going to New York but got diverted to Logan, and that was blocking a whole runway. And the way it played out, it sounds like the folks at Logan just sort of shut down, said, tilt, that's it. Everybody else gets to divert. And so Bradley at Hartford found itself with all these flights arriving that were unplanned for. But one of the things that McCartney said is kind of an observation from all this is that maybe there needs to be more coordination between airports when there's a situation like this.
Or maybe the airlines could just hire people that knew how to solve problems, and then we wouldn't have to worry about stupid laws that are not flexible enough to cover every single situation. Which, I mean, let's be serious. We were talking about that law. When did that come into effect? Was it last year, I think?
I think it was last year.
Yeah, and we all said the same thing. You know, there are going to be times where it just doesn't work.
Well, yeah. In that case where it doesn't work, I mean, we've had plenty of flights that have gone over the limit. As far as I know, we've yet to see a fine. So there is some kind of discretion there that the DOT has in terms of assessing these fines based on the circumstances, by the way I read that.
Yeah, and based on the circumstances that I understand from this particular incident, it really doesn't sound to me like JetBlue is the bad guy in this, and I don't think they should get fined.
No, hey, listen to that recording we just heard. I mean, I can't imagine anybody picking on JetBlue.
Listening to that pilot, I would give him absolutely kudos for everything he was trying. He obviously was on top of the situation. He was making the call. He's saying, you know, give me a welder. I'll make the darn tow bar.
Yeah.
It was great. I would not at all. I mean, personally, I don't think that JetBlue, it should be fined for that. But, you know, that whole law was just, you know, a political reaction to some unfortunate circumstances. And Robert, you're exactly right. If the people in the airlines were able to make decisions, maybe we wouldn't get into these positions.
All right. Again, our guest this episode is Jamie Dodson. He's a technology protection officer, and he's also author of the Nick Grant adventure novels. Again, Jamie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Max. It's great to be here, and it's really an honor to be with the Sitting in the Geeks in the virtual world headquarters.
We're happy to have you. Can you tell us who is Nick Grant?
Nick Grant is a figment of my imagination, but there is an actual Nick Grant who I used to work for when he was the senior intelligence officer of the 82nd Airborne Division. I was his operations officer, and he was actually an Army aviator for many, many years. Went by the handle Hawk 6, the sixth element, of course, in the Army, parlance being the commander. Mm-hmm. And I worked for him for a number of years. And then after I retired from the Army, and I've always been thinking about writing this, I dropped him a line and said, hey, you kind of embody a lot of the characters, a lot of the aspects that I'd like to kind of put into this character. And would you mind if I used your name? And he said, yeah, okay, Jamie, but, don't screw it up.
Yeah.
which is a typical General Grant, because he later went on to become a two-star general. Huh. But he is also, he's just retiring this year. In fact, I think next month is his last month. He works for one of Rob Mark's favorite organizations, the Transportation Security Office or something like that. And he's one of their chief intelligence officers. So there is life after the Army. Nick Grant can prove it.
So you know what I want to know, though? I know we're going to talk about other things, but the Nick Grant series, you were kind enough to ship us a couple of copies. And I read China Clipper last week, which is that the second book in the Nick Grant series?
That's book two, and I hope to think that it's a standalone as well. But of course, it does tie back to some of the things in Flying Boats and Spies.
Well, not like I was going to say. It was easy to follow anyway. I mean, and it's written, of course, for young adults, and I was fascinated though with the fact that you chose the 1930s and this whole aspect of what was going on with the Pan Am Clipper base at Alameda and. I'd really love to know how, maybe certainly at some point, tell us how you got started writing this, but how did you choose that era to write in?
Well, I was as a spanking new second lieutenant in the Army Intelligence Corps. I was stationed out in Honolulu, and I started looking around, and when I wasn't working, I was out like riding my bicycle with my 1 or 2 year old son on the back, and we stopped in at a library during one of those famous frequent liquid sunshine events that they have in Hawaii. And we picked up a book by an author named Carol Ney and started looking at all these phenomenal clippers. And it was just amazing to me, these enormous airplanes that were the biggest things on Earth. They were like flying Pullman cars in many respects. And it just sort of stuck with me. I was fascinated by the whole idea, and I did not realize that Trans-Pacific Airline service for passengers began in 1936. And then, of course, there's the entire aspect of Japan vehemently opposing the flight line and the flight, the whole China Clipper events, and taking it to the League of Nations, saying, "Hey, this is an obvious impairment of our sphere of influence." And then after that, after they were soundly said, "No, you invaded China, and you're killing thousands of people up there, and you're worried about an airliner crossing the Pacific. I think maybe there's something wrong with your perspective." But nonetheless, I started looking into it, and I worked with a lot of old Hawaii hands on Oahu who had been there in World War II, and they were just beginning to retire. But I actually got a chance to talk with a few of them, and they mentioned to me that the China Clipper had a couple of compartments in it, which were only the captain and the first officer had keys to, and they would carry dispatches from the embassies back and forth and other things of very classified and very sensitive nature. And I was thinking, wow, that's fascinating. And then I talked with another individual who said, oh, yeah, I remember that there was a sabotage event for the first China Clipper, and it happened at Alameda. And sure enough, there is an FBI file which talks to when the original China Clippers departed the 22nd of November 1935, two Japanese nationals were arrested actually inside the China Clipper screwing with the radio direction finding equipment so that they would not get the right azimuth and, you know, like miss Hawaii, which was not unusual in those days at all. And additionally, there was a, there's an event I write in the book, Rob, that you're probably familiar with, when the China Clipper was leaving Alameda Airport, what became known as Clipper Cove. Somebody had put in a almost like a caltrop of the water, a device that would rip the bottom of the hull out of the China Clipper as it went over it.
Wow, and, so that was true. Oh, that's,
that was actual. Yeah, that actually occurred. And when they FBI observed the Pan American people and the people from the airport pulling this thing out, it was pretty much the way I described it in the book. I think maybe the descriptions weren't as good, and I kind of, you know, I thought how it would look and added some of my own descriptions to it. But it was, you know, somebody was trying to sink that China Clipper before it even got off the ground. And, you know, if I would get you 10, it was probably the Japanese who had the, you know, they had the motive to do it. They had the opportunity, and they certainly had the technology to do it. No one will ever know.
Of course, you mentioned something about the book being a standalone, and that certainly is true because, as I said, David had the first volume in the series, and I had the second one. But I don't know exactly what I expected when it arrived, but I have to tell you that it was really very enjoyable. And, of course, speaking as the parent of a teenager, I mean, the conversations that Nick has with his mom and his dad about his secret activity saving the world, I mean, they were very well done. They really were. And now, of course, every time my daughter says, well, Dad, just I can't explain it right now. Just go with me on this and I'll explain it all later. I keep wondering, maybe she has this secret life somewhere.
It's like Nick, trust your feelings. and his parents too. Well, thank you, Rob. That's very nice of you to say. I appreciate that very much.
I'm in the process of finishing it up. But the reason why I'm delayed in reading it was I have a friend who is in her late 80s, who is a diehard reader, and I handed it over and said, here, read this. And she goes, it's an airplane book. I'm like, no, it's not. It's fiction. You'll like it. And she came back and thought it was absolutely fabulous. Considering it's a time period she lived through, she thought it was an amazing book. And if she hadn't had to go to bed, she would have read it in one sitting. So despite the fact it's written for younger people, folks, it's a good book. And if you're an airplane geek, it's a great book. And if you like history, it's even a better book.
Well, David, coming from you, that's high praise indeed, because I know few people, including at the University of Alabama in Huntsville in the history department, who have your background and your knowledge in aviation. I'm always absolutely amazed at the things you can just answer off the cuff. It's incredible. I'm in awe of you, David. What can I say?
and he's all ours.
Yeah. You and of course, his charming wife. You know, what's interesting, though, David, if I may just interrupt you briefly, Rob, is that I actually sell about one-third of the books to seniors who lived through that phase of the, you know, who lived through that time period. And to me, some of the greatest praise that I can get is someone who lived through that time period and said, well, Jamie, you know what? You got it about right. I mean, you know, you got it right. And that to me is great praise indeed.
Now, we should mention, Jamie, before we go too far, that folks who are interested can find your website at nickgrantadventures.com.
Yes, and also an easier way to do that, too, would be just to Google Nick Grant Adventures, you know, as three different words. Either way, and I've tried very hard to answer the questions of my readers and, you know, questions that come on. And I also have a Nick Grant group or fan page on Facebook. And there's a link on my webpage to that, too. So and what I do there is I try to post, things that are of interest from that era about flying boats and about, you know, the first, like, female stewards, the stewardesses that came on board and when, and little clips that I can find here and there. So, you know, if you're a Clipper wing nut, which I proudly am, you might enjoy it.
Now, you have a third book coming?
Well, I do. I'm being beaten about the head and shoulders by my publisher. If I don't get it done soon, I think I will wind up dead in the alley at some point. But every once in a while, life kind of gets in the way. Yeah, I have a third book. It's called Mission Shanghai. and it completes the first trilogy of the Nick Grant series. And I don't want to give too much away, but you know, if you've read the first or the second book, then you'll know that, oddly enough, Nick wants to be a pilot. He wants to fly Pan American airliners, flying boats of the day. He also wants to be an aeronautical engineer. So we'll see how he does in, you know, in his trials and tribulations as he gets sidetracked to, or I should say Shanghai, to Shanghai.
Jamie, you're in such a left brain kind of a world in your daily life. How did you end up in sort of a right brain side as a writer?
You know, that's an excellent question, and I wish I had an answer to it. I can tell you that I love to read. I've always loved to read. I like fiction. I'm an anomaly, perhaps, for an engineer, and that I really do enjoy fiction. And for me, I thought, well, you know, I'm fascinated by these flying boats, and I thought, well, what the heck? Let's give it a shot. And you know, here I am. As I take the typical engineering approach, okay, here's where I've got to be, and I'm getting out my system. I'm doing my waterfall charts, you know, figuring out how much effort, what's my LOE level of effort to get this done, and everything, you know. Yeah. And I'm looking, okay, 9 months, I got to have it done, right? Yeah. Well, it didn't quite turn out like that. There's actually, I found out there's a lot more to it than I had first imagined. In fact, I wonder if I had known it would take me 5 years before I finally was able to get someone to buy it, I wonder if I would have started it at all. But I'm fairly tenacious when I get a hold of something. I don't often let go. And I just kept going until eventually I got to something that that people have enjoyed. And, you know, and I'm glad to do it. And I really enjoy hearing from the readers and hearing from people who have enjoyed the stories. It's a really wonderful feeling, you know. And I figure if I sell 10 million more books, I might be able to quit my day job.
Yeah. Well, Jamie, you mentioned a publisher. I was going to ask you if you had difficulties finding a publisher, but also if you have any advice for other folks who might be contemplating writing an aviation-themed kind of book.
I do. Again, it's fairly simple. I believe in the KISS principle, which is keep it simple, stupid. That the stupid part is me. So what I would say to them is answer three questions initially about your story if you're writing fiction. And that is, what does your main character want? What stands in the way? And how does it end? And those are your basic tenets or the structure of most stories. And, you know, your main character has to want something. And the antagonist or something, it doesn't have to be a person, stands in the way. And what happens between what your main character wants and what stands in the way is the dynamic tension. And that, of course, is the DNA of storytelling. And then how it ends. I would tell people who are serious, and if they don't have a lot of writing experience, and I don't mean technical writing, because I've done a lot of technical writing, and it's very different. At least it was for me.
Yeah.
I would say find a writer critique group in your area that's in your genre. My genre is historical fiction and young adult. So I was able to find a national organization.
That's interesting.
Society of Children's Writers and Illustrators. And they had a couple of groups in the area. And I went to a couple of groups and I finally found one that worked very well for me. And writer critique groups are very, very wonderful for writers because you get people who have done it and who've done it a while. And I was very fortunate because three of the five people in my group were already published. So they had tremendous knowledge. But even just hearing somebody reading your story back to you, you go, oh, my God, I didn't really write that. Yeah, I started a chapter on a dark and stormy night. And you go, oh, my God, how did I do that?
Yeah.
So that's very, very important. I would tell you, for me, fiction writing, two other books are very, very critical. And one, it may surprise you, there's a book just been re-released by Stephen King called On Writing. And it's very accessible if you don't have a lot of, like, I'm not an English major, obviously. So a lot of what he was talking about, Stephen King was talking about, I had not heard before. And he's very easy to digest. He doesn't, you know, beat you to death with all these terms. But it's a great, he really tells you how to do it in a lot of good ways. A lot of good advice in there. The other one is Elements of Style, which I think was written in 19. And that is fabulous. I mean, mine is so well thumbed, you know, the spine is broken.
I know that one.
You know that one, okay.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say, you know, simple. And the most important thing is just do it, you know. Some people like to, you know, start writing and see where their characters take them. Some people, like me, I'm a little more dogmatic, and I'll kind of write my story arc and kind of divide up where I want to go, chapters 1 through 30. I may not even have the same number of chapters by the time I'm done, but that way, if I get into like a writer's block or I'm stuck on chapter 4, I kind of know what's going to happen in 26, so I can write that part. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. I mean, and again, there's all different ways of doing it. This is just how it's worked for me.
Now, how about your aviation background and experience? Were you in the airborne infantry?
Yes, and I have several minutes of flight underneath a T-10 Charlie parachute. And then also when I was in special operations and special forces, we jumped the MC-1-1 Bravos and one Charlies. I've been out 10 years, so I think that they're now up to the T-11s for the conventional, like 82nd Airborne kind of guys, airborne infantry. And the guys who are jumping, guys and gals, by the way, in the 82nd, I don't want to leave the ladies out. They're the best jump masters in the world. In the Special Operation Forces, I think they're up to the MC-1-1 Deltas now, which is a lower porosity chute. So you're falling at about 13 to 15 feet per second, as opposed to the T-10, which is coming down, you know, to scream in 18 to 20. So you can really thump in if you don't do a good parachute landing fall. I was also the intelligence officer for the 18th Aviation Brigade, which is part of the 18th Airborne Brigade Corps. And in that capacity, my commander, Colonel Green, was, Dotson, if you're going to do intelligence for us, you've got to know what we do. assigned me an instructor pilot, and I got the opportunity to go out and actually, you know, hands-on fly the OH-58 Delta model. These are helicopters, OH-58 Charlie model, UH-60, and the MH-60, the Mike model. And then they wouldn't let me fly the Chinook because they said it was too expensive and I had too many transmissions. I always wanted to be a pilot from the time I flew across the Atlantic Ocean when I was 7 years old on a Pan American Rainbow Clipper. Unfortunately, I do not have or did not have the eyesight. Thank gosh those rules have changed. And now, you know, sport pilot is something I can do. Of course, with three kids in college, I may have to wait a little bit longer.
Yeah, but it's never too late.
No, and I'm a member of the EAA Chapter 190, which is out of Moontown Airport, just east of Huntsville. It's a grass strip. It's a great, oh man, talk about it. It's like walking back into the 30s going in that place. And I've had an opportunity to fly, get up in a Champ, you know, and I was probably scared to death out of the instructor, you know, trying to bring it in on that grass strip. And what's this, Rob, what is this slip thing? What does it mean when you have to slip an airplane and it doesn't have flaps? I was very confused about that.
Oh, no. It actually, what that means is that you're trying to do something in an airplane that you're not supposed to, and you lose your balance, you fall out of the seat.
That's why
the airplane flies sideways and you almost hit the ground.
Were you there? Did you see that?
Yeah. No, it's completely, it bamboozles a lot of pilots when they start because you're taught from early on to use coordination and a little left wheel, a little left aileron, a little left rudder, and all. And a slip is just completely the opposite. You might pull the left aileron down and kick full right rudder in there, and it makes the airplane fly sideways. So it turns sort of the wide part of the airplane to the wind, and it helps you come down faster. You just have to know when to pull out of it.
Yeah, that was the hard part. Well, thanks for setting me straight. Gosh, I wish you were up here to be my instructor.
Rob is everyone's favorite instructor.
Well, until they fly with me.
Yeah.
Actually, I thought Linda Meeks would be a great instructor. I just love that she was.
Wasn't she? Yes.
Wasn't she fun last week? Yeah, we had
she
a good
was
time.
Great. And of course, a former Army officer, so I had some kindred spirit with her.
That's true. Yes, I'm sure. Anything else that we didn't talk about that you wanted to make sure we did?
You didn't talk about your life as a spy or anything. But
no, well, that's secret stuff.
No, I mean, I kind of did early on. My background was initially when I was in Hawaii, I was in plain clothes and, not wearing uniform, long hair, Hawaii shirt, Zoris. Literally, I was sort of like living the life of Magnum PI, and it was so hysterical. I'm like, wow. What am I doing here? You know, are you sure you got the right guy? Well, I was working counterintelligence. We were at the time chasing a lot of Chinese spies, which is interesting because that's kind of what I'm doing here in Huntsville now, you know, only 30 years later.
Right.
After that, I was at strategic level intelligence and counterintelligence. I got into the tactical world down with the, you know, the mud and the blood and the beer. And I really like that a lot. I like being with the troops. And I got to tell you, if you can't lead soldiers in the 82nd Airborne Division, you don't have a hope in hell of being any kind of leader, because those people, those soldiers were so willing to do anything to get the mission done. I tell you what, the airborne soldier, you know, and I'm not trying to belittle other soldiers. That's just what I know. They're amazing. And I looked at them every day and I thought, how does our country produce such fine human beings, such amazingly selfless individuals? And, you know, even today, I'm like, oh, my God, these guys and gals are just so amazing. It's, you know, it makes you proud to be an American.
Yeah, that's very cool.
And, of course, tying that in with Veterans Day, too, what our young people can go through, and I'm talking, you know, people my children's age and younger now and older, you know, not as old as Rob, but older. They just do amazing things. I'm so impressed by them. I have no doubt about America. I'm very optimistic because the young people in America, and I include Dan Webb in this, they're really great. I mean, don't listen to the news because they don't get it right.
Yeah, we know that.
I'll get off my soapbox now. Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's
good. You mean there will be a job for Dan when he graduates in June?
Yeah, I think
God
so.
Willing.
All right. Well, Jamie, thanks again for joining us. It's been really interesting. And again, folks can find your books at nickgrantadventures.com. And that must be available on Amazon, places like that.
Right. Amazon. I also sell, they're also stocked by about 10, 12 different aviation museums across America. And if you want an autographed copy, you can get it from my website. And I'd be happy to send it out to you.
Fantastic. All right. Jamie, thanks again.
Thanks, geeks. It was my great honor.
It's time for David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, to give us his This Week in Aviation report.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode Number 33, November 13th through November 19th. November 13th, 1926, Major Mario D. Bernetti of Italy pilots the Mach-E M39 seaplane to a victory over Hampton Roads, Virginia, to win the 1926 Snyder Cup trophy. Italy sent three M39s. One dropped out of the race. The other came in third place. DiBernetti won setting the then world record of 246.49 miles per hour, or 396.69 kilometers per hour, in a seaplane. The M39 had used an asymmetrical wing, where the left wing was longer than the right. This was because the course was consistently left turns, much like our beloved NASCAR, go fast, turn left. That wing actually would show up later in World War II in the Italian fighter, the Mach-E MC-202 Foglor, which in translation in Italian is Thunderbolt. November 14th, 2005, Boeing aircraft announced the 747-8, the fourth generation 747. Less than 6 years later, the 747-8 in its two variants, the 8F and the 8I, freighter and intercontinental, deliveries have begun. Currently, there are 111 firm purchase orders, and the majority are for the freighter version. Dateline, November 16th, 1920. Paul McGinnis, Hudson Fysh, Fergus McMaster, and Arthur Baird found a small airline. It would eventually become the Queensland and Northern Territories Air Service, otherwise known as Qantas. 91 years later, almost to the date, Alan Joyce has worked hard to destroy the brand. November 17th, 1927. Alan John Cobham makes the first circumnavigation of Africa. Cobham using the Schwartz Singapore flying boat. He only landed in British territory. G-E-U-B-E-B-U-P was a prototype. The flight left Rochester, England, and arrived at the Cape of Good Hope on March 30th, 1928. It returned to Rochester on June 4th, 1928. The flight's success caused the RAF to purchase 34 more of the Singapores. The Singapores would be used for both the RAF and Royal New Zealand Air Force. The other interesting note about the Singapore was that it was a four-engine aircraft with two nacelles. It had two push propellers in the front and two tractor propellers in the front and two push propellers in the back. First flights that occurred during the week of November 13th through November 19th. November 15th, 1949, the Beechcraft Model 50, otherwise known as the U-8 Seminole or Twin Bonanza. November 17th, 1956, the Dassault Mirage 3. November 18th, 1978, the McDonnell Douglas F-18 Hornet. And that's the way it was, November 13th through November 19th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
All right. Thank you, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 13th of November, 2011.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 173. And welcome to the president of the Balloon Association of Victoria. Grant, are you there?
Hey, whoa. Hold on a minute. Wait a minute. I'm not the president.
You're not the president? I thought you were the president. Okay, well, it must be the vice president. Well, welcome, folks, and welcome the vice president.
No. I'm not the vice president either.
Oh, well, what are you then? You've taken some high office this week in the ballooning community. What is it?
I am the secretary of the Balloon Association of Victoria.
Oh, get it right. Well, I've got a theme just for you there.
Oh, ha, ha, ho, ho, it is to laugh. Actually, that's very apt. Thanks very much.
Oh, no worries. Now, okay, in all vague seriousness, because, you know, we are very serious here on the Australia Desk, Grant. Tell us all about the meeting and what positions they wanted to foist upon you.
Well, we had the AGM and the voting in of a whole new group of executives for the Balloon Association of Victoria, and my arm had been royally twisted into taking on the role of secretary, which is sort of like project manager and things like that.
Oh,
so it's what I do anyhow.
I was going to say, it's not like you're not busy or anything during the week, Grant.
It's not like I'm not very busy running a expanding ballooning operation and, looking after the Plane Crazy Down Under show and doing all sorts of stuff with you on really cool projects. No. And don't forget family. There's family in there. So I think what this means is that I've just moved sleep to being that which occurs between 1:30 in the morning and 1 o'clock. No, I got to move something around because that's getting up half an hour after I go to bed.
I think what you'll need to do is get more cans of Red Bull into you. That's just my tip.
Yeah, very likely.
Oh, well, that's congratulations anyway, mate. That's good news. Good news for balloonists everywhere in Victoria.
I'm sure they don't agree.
And good news for business travellers this week is that Virgin, after we spoke about it last week, Grant, well, sort of.
Yeah, well,
is go mention. For business class.
That's right. Their new business class tickets have come in on the Golden Triangle, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and they're definitely going ahead. They've got their own little section of the aircraft and some beautiful leather seats. So quite nice, I must admit.
And being very aggressive now, going up against Qantas, and why wouldn't they? We heard John Borghetti talking about that last week in the Ausdesk, and I'll tell you what, Grant, they're saying here that a Melbourne-Sydney flight business class is $559 one way, so I wonder what Qantas is charging, because that to me seems like a hell of a lot of money, even though it is, business class.
Yeah, I know. It's a lot of money for a one-hour flight, I tell you. But I guess there's people out there who pay it, and I think it gives you all sorts of extras like lounge access and full flexibility and all that kind of stuff. But it's still way out of my league. But meanwhile, it's good news in a week where Qantas has just been stalling the unions, and the unions are sort of, saying they want to go and protest about the fact that they can't protest. And I mean, the only other real news coming out of Qantas is about putting the A380s on the Hong Kong run.
Yeah, looking at an article here on the AustralianAviation.com.au website, it says Hong Kong next for Qantas A380s, and we can confirm that because they've actually been out spruiking that in the media this week. They're scheduled to take delivery of their 11th A380 in a few weeks, and they've got the 12th one coming before the end of this year. So I guess that's only a few weeks away too, now that I think about it. So now they're going to be replacing 747-400s on that route, and putting on A380s. Looks like on Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays.
Some people are calling that a strategic move. I don't know about calling that a strategic move, mate. It's just recognising the fact that they need to put something new on the run to get passengers on.
Now, Grant, one more airline that we haven't mentioned for quite some time. It's actually because they're quite small. And speaking of strategies, strategic airlines, but strategic airlines. Now, we spoke about them a little while back and said they were looking to, get out of the charter business, which is predominantly what they did, and moving into regular public transport flights. And Grant, their rebranding is Air Australia.
That's right, mate. Not Air America. This is Air Australia. It's not a government operation. It's a small group running an A330 and a couple of A320s, and they're going to go across the Pacific. And they've already been doing Bali kind of routes and things like that from Australia to Bali and parts of Indonesia and Asia. They're now branching out across the Pacific and rebranding as Air Australia, which I think is a great thing and is going to be fascinating to watch happen.
That change will officially take place from Strategic Airlines to Air Australia on November 15th. And they're going to be pitching themselves as a low-cost carrier. So it's just we need another low-cost carrier.
Well, something that's definitely not low-cost, but it is a bit of a carrier, mate. RAAF have just received their third KC-30. That's right. It's a tanker topic.
It's a tanker. Shh, don't you upset the historian. We don't want to be doing that.
I know. Sorry, I didn't want to be a bit of a tanker on that one.
The third KC-30A has now been delivered to the Royal Australian Air Force and will be joining its two sister ships in 33 Squadron up there at RAAF Base Amberley in Queensland. So good news. We need to get those tankers online.
The fourth one's going to be handed over in December, and a fifth one is going to be handed over next year.
So there you go. That's a bit of a wrap-up of what's going on news-wise down here in Australia this week. Been pretty quiet after a couple of very heavy news weeks, so we thought we'd indulge ourselves and talk a bit about Grill the Geeks. Grant, Grill the Geeks. Let's grill the geeks ourselves. I think we should do that. You know, Dan mentioned the other week, and I was most disturbed about this on many levels, that he said he's never watched Battlestar Galactica. Can you believe that?
Oh, mate, he hasn't done so many things. I mean, for a kid who's supposed to be into aviation, I mean, really, you know, Battlestar Galactica is just a given. If you're into aviation, you go with that. It's great.
I like all the evil characters in these things, and I happen to like the Cylons, the Centurion Cylons. You know, they mentioned that they've never had any Centurions on the show, but that's not exactly true, Grant. That's not true at all.
There
actually has been. Centurion Cylon has made an appearance on the Airplane Geeks. So that's the Grill of Geeks question for this week, Grant.
I know. Was that the episode where Waldorf and Stadler were on? They've been on at least twice, haven't they?
I think it was. Did they mention they hadn't been on the show either?
I know. They're so slack, those boys. They don't remember all the guests they've had on their show.
All right, then. So we're hijacking this segment, guys. This is what we want to do. And I've got a stack of Airplane Geeks buttons here that I stole from Rob Mark's office. Did I say that? No. That Rob Mark gave to me when I was in America. So I will personally send an Airplane Geeks button to anyone who can tell us where the Cylon Centurion made an appearance in an episode of Airplane Geeks. Let's say within the last, I don't know, Grant, let's make it easy, in the last 50 episodes.
Oh, I'd say the last 2 years.
All right, so that's what we want to know. Where did the Cylon Centurion make a cameo appearance? It may have been in one of our segments, or it may have been somewhere else. So let's say within the last 50 episodes, and I'll let you ponder that until next week. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm still Grant McCarran.
That's if they don't sack us for doing that. You know, they might fire us for doing that, Grant.
Yeah, I know. But hey, at least I'm still the secretary.
Hey, yay.
Wow, that's some trivia.
Okay, just to everyone, just calm down. Battlestar Galactica, I believe the whole series is on Hulu Plus, which I subscribe to. So
you got some catching up to do, Dan.
Once I hit winter break and finals are over, I can do some Battlestar time.
Okay. In his Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson picks up where he left off last week with Gareth Stringer and Tim Robinson. Here they are.
Another couple of stories in the news are that Jersey and Guernsey are starting or thinking of starting their own civil register, similar to the Isle of Man, and also our good friends Ryanair, who have been voted the world's worst airline. Any views on those two?
I think that obviously Guernsey and Jersey have looked at the success of the Isle of Man, which has now got 413 biz jets in its registry under the MREG. It's now the eighth largest biz jet registry in the world, and decided they want a bit of piece of the action. You know, they're under the UK sort of CAA, but they can still, you know, use it to attract business, raise the flag around the world. Ironically, actually, I saw an M-registered Isle of Man biz jet in Kazakhstan on the pan there, which is amazing. You know?
Yeah, that's...
Presumably there's a financial benefit to that, for a direct financial benefit to doing that as well, is there, Tim?
Well, the Isle of Man don't run it. They don't run it as a profit thing. The whole thing is to get people to bank there and conduct business there, and provide a sort of a service. You know, a faster, quicker service. For example, you know, that they can't wait for the usual sort of CAA. Yeah, it'll be ready. You know, 6 months' time. When you're kind of a high powered individual, a high worth net worth individual, and you really need this biz jet, you know, next week.
Yeah.
Okay.
And finally, then, what are the views on Ryanair being nominated the world's worst airline? I personally, I think it's a bit harsh. However, having flown them, I could once or twice have been in that category.
It's interesting, isn't it? We get. Yeah, you see surveys of this ilk on a whole variety of subjects all the time these days. And sometimes they're quite enlightening. Sometimes the headlines perhaps are more, you know, are more worthy than the actual content of them. I mean, personally, I think I prefer to maybe look at more, you know, direct anecdotal evidence from people that I speak to. And I suppose in that regard, I'm not particularly surprised. I've never had a bad experience with them. I'll say that straight off. But a lot of people I speak to just don't seem to have a good word for them. And equally, they do fall victims of their own media strategy, I think, because this is an airline which generates a lot of negative press, and in terms of announcements, not necessarily always actions, but in terms of things that they're thinking they might do and such like. And I do wonder sometimes if that quest for column inches that they've obviously got is actually doing them less favours than they might think. So I was just going to say, the old axiom of any PR is good PR, in my experience, is not always true.
Rather unusual news from Ryanair. Normally we have you coming into this studio and you're gloating about how great your latest profits are. What's happened?
Well, I mean, the profits have fallen by 27%, which is in line with our guidance. And the good news for people is it's because of lower airfares.
I never cease to marvel at the way you're able to take a difficult question and turn it round into another plug for Ryanair.
As long as it leaves
a unique talent.
Declan, I do think we've got to keep the pressure on the security authorities. You know, you have these nonsense regulations about carry-on liquids and 100ml bottles and cosmetics. You know, lipsticks are the new weapons of mass destruction. This is nothing but bloody politics. And the sooner we get back to sensible security, the better for it will be for the airline industry and also for the UK government.
No, tell us what you really think.
I think if you look at their actual on-time record as well as their lost luggage record, it's certainly not the worst in the world. So it is a lot of other contributing anecdotal evidence that seems to have got them to the top. I think the other thing that seems to have allowed Ryanair to be successful, but force people to almost have to use them, is the routes that they fly. They manage to strategically grow the network very cleverly to locations where people have now become dependent. And some of the French airports, where particularly British people have bought properties, it's the only way to get there now.
Yeah,
that's a good point. Now, is you know, sort of the saturation of the market is you know, how many trips to Latvia do you really want to go to in 1 year? But also, as you say, people now have bought holiday properties on the basis of, oh, well, there's a cheap Ryanair service that connects it, not realizing that Ryanair, it's a business. It may decide to keep that service open. It may pull it back.
Yeah.
Also, as well, is that they... What's not realised now is that they may have a bit more trouble flying to new airports, because a lot of the new airports, a lot of the airports in Europe would almost sort of pay Ryanair to come to them, because they know that they get all this extra ancillary revenue, that the local economy would benefit, etc. You know, hotel bookings would go up. So there's a great thing in the past for get Ryanair or get any low cost carrier to come to your airport.
Mm.
Now, however, there's a financial crunch, and you've got to ask. Well, have all these, you know, places in Spain, Portugal, Greece, around Europe. You know, times are tight. You know, have these local authorities now got the money to kind of try and lure Ryanair back, or lure a new low cost carrier in to come in, and you know, to their sort of little regional airport?
Okay, guys, I think we're just about running out of time. Starting with you, Gareth, where can we find you online?
Well, if you head to globalaviationresource.com, that will point you in the direction of our websites and also our new monthly magazine. And you can find me on Twitter at Gareth_Stringer.
And Tim?
Yep, if you go to Aerosociety, www.aerosociety.com, that's the Royal Aeronautical Society site, and I'm at R-A-E-S, Tim R, on Twitter.
Guys, thanks again for joining us.
You can find Peter Johnson at Nascot Hornet and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com.
All right. Thank you, Peter, Gareth, and Tim. All right. You know what that means. It's time for Grill the Geeks again. First one comes from Ben. This actually came in a few weeks ago. Well, actually, more than a few weeks ago. And this is a question for Dan, although I suppose anybody can take a stab at this. Ben says, I recently took a flight from London Heathrow Airport to Dusseldorf International Airport on Lufthansa LH3389. The aircraft was a Boeing 737-500. I noticed that there was no seating row 17 on this aircraft. Is this common, and what would be the reason for it? And he sent along a picture of a seat map for reference.
I don't know why Lufthansa does it specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes airlines can do it for consistency purposes. So I think, for example, United, for example, like there could, you could have first class and then row, like the first row of coach starts at like a few rows after first class. So like it could go 1, 2, 3, 4, 7. I don't know, 7, 8, whatever. I don't know the exact order. It varies by aircraft, but that way there's some kind of consistency so that like an exit row is always in the same row. I'm not sure if that's the reason that Lufty does it though.
Hey Dan.
Yeah. Damn it. Why?
Wrong answer.
What's the reason Lufty does it?
All right. Now, there's in that seating diagram that Ben sent, there's kind of a clue. Because if you notice, there's another row that also doesn't appear on that airplane.
There's no 13. Oh, is it some kind of superstition thing?
Yes. It turns out it is. I guess mostly in the Italian culture, the number 17 is kind of considered an unlucky number.
Ah.
And the reason is kind of interesting. I guess it's when you look at, this is sort of convoluted in my mind, but this is kind of the explanation that when you look at 17 in Roman numerals, XVII, well, you can change that anagrammatically to VIXI, which in Latin, this is great, which in Latin, it translates into I have lived, which is it's a euphemism for my life is over or I am dead.
Ah.
Yeah, so in this case, it's an unlucky number. So I think Ben gets the button.
Yes.
All right, we can do, let's do one more. This one comes from Jamie Dotson.
Oh, that was planned.
How timely. Okay, he says, what was the first, or he, like you're not here, Jamie said, what was the first commercial airliner to go into service powered by turbine engines?
I have my guess.
I have a guess also.
I'd say it's the Viscount, but.
That's my guess. The Viscount with Rolls-Royce engines. What's the model? It's on the tip of my tongue.
Oh, darn it. I learned my butt.
Oh, yeah. It's on the tip of my tongue, too, but I don't want to embarrass
Aren't
anybody.
They the darts?
Darts. That's it. The darts.
You're right.
Is it?
I guess I didn't stump you, geeks.
Is it right? It's the Vickers Viscount?
You're right. You got it all right. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, that was good.
Good job, so, geeks.
So was that our last question?
No, we should really do it since Jamie blew it and didn't stop us, we should do a third one.
Okay.
Okay.
This one comes from Dave in the UK.
Hi, Dave.
Dave writes, during the Cold War, Soviet aircraft were given reporting names.
Yeah.
What type aircraft were the following? So there's four, and then there's an extra hard one.
All right. Let's start off with the extra hard one and work backwards.
Really? You want to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. The Fred.
Fred, so it's a male, it's a single term, it's a one syllable word, so it's a propeller driven aircraft. It's an F. What?
No.
Okay, what's the Fred?
A Bell P-63 King Cobra.
Well, I was getting there.
Were you going there?
I was getting there. It was a single syllable, so therefore it was a propeller-driven aircraft, which is the King Cobra. It was Fred, which means it was began with an F, so it was a fighter. And yes, and if it was a male, it would have been designated a previous U.S. aircraft. So yes, a P-63. What are the other ones?
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Midas.
Of course.
Midas is an Aleutian transport. It's got it's their equivalent. It's the IL-76. It's the equivalent of the AWACS. It has a rotodome on top of it.
He says the Aleutian 78 tanker.
Okay. Well, I got that one wrong.
Krusty.
Two syllables. Jet. C. Cargo. That one I don't know.
I still think you're amazing, David. It's a Tupolev 134.
Oh, I was just going to say that.
Right. What's the fourth one?
Fencer.
Fencer, SU-24.
Yep.
Strike fighter, swing wing, F-111 equivalent.
And one more.
Wow.
Jeez, the last one, faggot. Sorry, that's what it says. Well,
faggot, as in British cigarette, small British cigarette, not the euphemism used in the United States.
Right.
A two-syllable word, which is a jet-engined aircraft beginning with an F, commonly known as the MiG-15.
That's it. Wow.
Damn. Wow.
Wow, David. Oh, I am so impressed.
That's absolutely amazing,
now,
David.
Now, let's give him the disclaimer that he had not heard any of this before.
No, no, no.
The question.
This is first time. I keep these secret. Time.
Damn! So, boy, that boy, good.
He is good. Now you didn't get it 100%, but it was pretty close.
We'll send him the pins.
Okay.
Do we have his address?
Not in front of me.
Okay, Dave, send your address to us.
Meanwhile, I have a Grill the Geeks clarification.
You have an addendum, huh?
Yeah, from last week.
What do you got, Dan?
All right. So there was a question last week, and I believe it was which airline has both Pratt and Rolls-Royce engines on its 757s and 777s. And David said United. And while it is completely true that, and actually kudos to Gavin Werbeloff for bringing this to my attention, I don't want to take credit for this, David said it was United. And that is true for the 757s, but not for the 777s. United has Pratt on its 777s, but Continental on its 777-200ERs has the GE90. So, and as far as I can tell, from what I've looked at, there is no airline out there that has both Pratt and Rolls-Royce 777s.
Yeah.
Of course, I could be wrong, but I know that United is not one of those airlines.
So maybe a little fact-checking is in order here. All right, well, thanks, Dan, for that. Let's move on to some listener mail. First up, this is from Brad. Brad had a couple questions. We talked about the ME-262, or David did last time. Dan, Brad asks a question of you. He says, could you expound on Allegiant Airlines' business model, specifically related to their use of MD-80 series aircraft, and the economics of using those specific cheap but fuel-guzzling aircraft versus using other older but newer than the MD-80s? Aircraft, for example, 737 Classics.
The fact that it's so absolutely cheap, I mean, it really kind of just goes down to that. I found an old, I mean 2 years old, LA Times article, and roughly Allegiant can buy and refurb an MD-80 for about $4 million. So That's very, very cheap. So yeah, I mean, it's not the most fuel-efficient airplane, but it's pretty cheap, and that compensates for it. And I mean, Allegiant actually today, I mean, is still posting pretty strong margins, so they're able to deal with it. As for why they selected the MD-80 compared to other used aircraft, my only guess, I'm really not a used aircraft expert, is the market was probably a bit better for them for the MD-80. I'm really not sure about that, and I know like when they got started, I think they did start with the DC-9 family with a single DC-9, so that could have been part of it. But I mean, they seem to love the MD-80, and in fact, they actually just announced on Friday they're purchasing 13 MD-80s and 12 JT-8Ds from SA. Well, to purchase up to 13 MD-80s and 12 JT-8Ds from SAS.
Ah, yes.
They'll say those purchases will, quote, primarily be used to replace engines that will be coming due for major overhauls over the next 2 years, unquote. But it says the agreement also allows Allegiant, the flexibility to use several of the aircraft for additional MD-80 fleet growth in the future should decide to do so. So they have this flexibility. And also, they're kind of making the MD-80 more fuel efficient, not really in terms of fuel burn, but they're currently converting those airplanes to seat 166 people. So you at least have more butts and seats to spread over that fuel cost. Allegiant is also building up a small fleet of 757s. It'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Okay. Hey, Michael writes in, love your podcast. I recently heard on a local radio talk show that the MQ-9 Global Hawk drone is being tested as an aerial tanker. And he sent some links along to go with that. David, were you aware of this?
In fact, if we go back like 6 months ago, there was an Airplane Geeks article by yours truly about this topic.
I thought it sounded mildly familiar, but I just couldn't, you know, six months ago.
It's a DARPA project. They are testing two Global Hawks to be able to refuel autonomously. You know, it's my two favorite topics in the world, tankers and UAVs. It's still in its infancy, I mean, but to be able to refuel a Predator drone to give it even longer loiter time from another drone, it's just growing the program. The other thing is, one of the tests is eventually will be to be able to refuel a drone off of a tanker or with the Navy X-45, which will be the carrier-based drone, to be able to refuel from like an F-18 towing a drogue. So tanking is the next step for UAVs. Now, things like Global Hawks have incredibly long endurance time. So it's really one of those, I don't know if we're ever going to really need it, but the option is there. So,
okay.
So it's not new news, but it's not, it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Thanks, David. And let's see, maybe we can zip through a couple of these because we're running short on time and we have quite a lot of mails here. Just mentioned Bob Iverson sent a nice email in. He commented on, we've been dumping some sort of extra episodes, not really episodes, but some extra content into the feed. I've had a couple on the AOPA summit, and David had one on the Sky Typers, and Bob enjoyed those. So thanks for the feedback on those, Bob. Also, we heard from Diego from Spain. Diego had a question about why there are no smoking signs or signals over the seats in airliners. And this is when smoking isn't even permitted. Interesting question.
Yeah, so a couple things. Number one, I mean, for some airplanes, they were older, and I don't think, you know, it's not exactly a big feature that you need to change. Secondly, on some newer aircraft, there are still some no smoking signs, but I've noticed at least up overhead, there's a seatbelt sign, but where there are the illuminated no smoking sign was, there's now a electronics off sign. But actually, I did some digging last night, and actually it appears that no smoking signs are still required. They're actually FARs, Federal Aviation Regulations, about this. So if you dig into the FARs, Diego, if you go to section 25.791 or 121.317, it goes through it, but apparently it appears that no smoking signs, at least in the FAA, are still required on aircraft. Not necessarily an illuminated sign, but they do need to be present. Yeah, I don't know about the other regulatory bodies out there.
And then we wonder why Dan has trouble getting a date.
Some good research there, Dan.
Yeah.
So we want to thank Diego for asking that. Diego, of course, is from the aeropodcast.com podcast. It's a Spanish language podcast. The production quality sounds great. So if our Spanish-speaking audience, and I know we have quite a large one, actually, from our Twitter followers, I can tell that. But yeah, you might want to take a look at that if you haven't heard it already. That's www.aeropodcast.com. So thanks to Diego. We got a voicemail from Ian, just real briefly. This is about e-books. Ian mentioned that he's sort of had a little bit of trouble finding e-books on aviation topics. I mentioned to him that Kevin Garrison, past guest, has some ebooks out on Amazon.com. I don't know if you guys are aware of any other ebooks that are out there.
I happen to know of one.
Is it by you?
It is, actually.
Shocker.
You have an ebook, Rob?
Yeah, that career pilot book I wrote a couple of years ago got turned into one of the early ebooks that McGraw-Hill flipped. I don't think that helped sales at all, but hey, it sounded pretty cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe we can just ask our listeners if they're aware of any ebooks that are out there on Amazon.com or other, places like that.
I wonder if the Nick Grant Adventures are ebooks.
You know, they're not. And the reason they're not is my publisher was reluctant to get into it initially. And then they started down that road. But wouldn't you know it, they chose a book that was a little bit easier than mine to do for the first one. But I tell you, I get probably 5 to 6, maybe a few more a week asking me, is it available on Kindle or is it available Barnes & Noble? And those are just lost sales. So I would recommend anybody out there who is an aviation author, get it done because the market's there.
Great. Okay. Maybe this will be our last one. We got a question from Dave in the UK. He says he recently flew back from Palma, Mallorca on a first-choice Airbus 320. He says, we taxied down for departure but stopped at an intersection and let 4 Air Berlin 737s and an ATR 72 out in front of us, even though it looked that we could have safely passed the intersection to depart in front of them. Palma Air is an Air Berlin hub, so it got me thinking whether some airlines are given preferential treatment by controllers to ensure that they depart promptly. So, interesting question. Rob, do you have an answer for this?
I think it's probably clear that David didn't have his airplane geeks button to flash.
That's your priority, status.
That would have given them priority. Actually, I mean, here in the States, it's supposed to be first come, first serve, which is normally the way air traffic is run, except that when there are slots and there are time frames that airlines or airplanes, business airplanes, must comply with, that's often while they'll let some aircraft out ahead of time. It's also dependent on the fix that they're filed out of. The airplane that David might have been on could have been one that they just let 5 departures out on headed to that same direction, and they need to get some other airplanes out headed in another direction. And they just might happen to have been Air Berlin flights because they kind of own the airport. Normally, I would say it would be strange for them to give a company priority, but I guess it could happen. I just haven't really experienced that. Maybe some of our controller friends here in the States or someplace else, maybe if we talk to Jesus over in Spain, he might have something to say about that because he works in Eurocontrol or an element of Eurocontrol, and he might be able to tell us something about that.
Or pitch it down to ATC Ben down in Australia.
ATC Ben.
Very good point.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's all we have time for.
I just want to ask our guest one last thing before he leaves. Jamie, will there be any interesting research coming up in an episode of Nick Grant that you'll have pulled from any of these airplane geek topics tonight?
Well, thank you for asking that, Rob. I'm going to tell you that I envision 3 separate trilogies, and I'm thinking hard about a 4th trilogy. So anything that I would have gleaned from the airplane geeks will undoubtedly be in the 4th trilogy, which should be published about 12 years after I'm dead.
All right, well, thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Jamie Dodson. Jamie, again, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, man, it was a blast. I'll tell you what, it's one of the highlights of my life.
Oh, well, you can find
you obviously don't get out much, do you?
Well, us writers are rather chained to our desks.
Hey, it was good to have you.
It really was. My pleasure. We'd like to thank our contributors, Grant McHaren and Steve Vischer from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast. Also, Peter Johnson. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, let's start with you.
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, or you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof.
And Rob Mark?
Well, they can find us on Twitter at Jetwine. They'll find me on jetwine.com. And also at ComAvia, which is our company site, and who knows where else in the coming weeks and months and years.
Hey, Dan Webb.
Before I say my thing, hi, Shell. Secondly, where you can find me.
Say your thing, Dan.
Right. You can find me on the interwebs at thingsinthesky.com, and you can also find me on the Twitter at Dan Webbage.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus as Max Flight, where I've been increasingly active. Also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory, or on Twitter at Max Flight. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. That'll have links to the sites we mentioned on this podcast. And be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message.
What number would they dial?
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thanks, Ampanay.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. And if you'd really like to help us out, go tell your friends about the Airplane Geeks podcast. Meantime, join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye now.
Come across
as someone who's met Rob physically, it's really overrated. damn it, Dan. Okay, total fuel consumption. Where is this? I'm gonna hold on a second, guys. I'm sorry. Perhaps if only we had Bruce Willis to manage everything for us.
Yeah, Hollywood can solve everything.
Yeah, we'll have to put Benet on that.
That was a shout out to Benet. If we just had Bruce Willis holding whatever flaming stuff he had on, signaling in the flight to land. Wasn't he holding something on fire, I think?
I think so, yeah. Shooting it down with his 9mm.
I'm sure Benet can clear it up for us.
Absolutely.
Yes. You know, despite ribbing by Rob on a regular basis, you know your stuff. And, you know, if I was in a hiring area in your expertise, I would very seriously consider you. You come across very well, Dan. You're very impressive.
Mm. Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
Yeah.
You obviously haven't met him in person, have you?
Oh, no. Don't
say that. Oh, God. Oh, man. Oh, geez.
I'm
just kidding, Dan. Yeah. He knows I love him. He's the son I never had.
Aw.
Yeah. Oh, that's
aww.
Sweet.
Aw, Skype group hug.
In fact, Dan, get your butt home and clean your room. It is a mess.
And do your homework.
And you were supposed to do the grass, too. Yeah. How about we try something new? Let's tell everybody that the Australian desk was a bad file and we couldn't listen
corrupted.
To it.
It was corrupt.
There you go. Yeah. And so Steve and Grant are in jail or something because they're corrupt. Well, okay. Never mind.
3, 2, 1. Hang on. The funny date didn't come up.
Are you Linux guys?
No, this is a Windows machine balking out on me.
Oh, God.
Hang on. Normally I hover the mouse over the clock and it brings me the date time, and it's not today.
You know, the other thing you mentioned was John Galt. Did you hear that, Grant? John Galt, out of that book.
Which one?
You know, this book.
Atlas Shrugged. By Ayn Rand.
There you go. That John Galt, I actually believe he ran a rail company.
All aboard, train's good, plane's bad.
Woo-hoo!
Too much
there's more
fun.
Chance of us doing beer crazy down under than train crazy down under.
You know, I think what would be really great if, since we have been changing up roles, at least in this show, if maybe one week our little piece of aviation history could give us the aviation history segment.
Which in Latin it translates into "I have lived," which is a kind of a euphemism. But that's a tough word.
Euphemism.
Thank you, Jamie. The writer comes through.
Con, give me a second. I'm going to try to find something. Give me a second. Please hold. I'm almost right. Yeah, so for example, I'm looking at some seat maps of United Continental stuff here. So like a United A319
right.
has row 1 and 2, which is first class.
Sorry, you caught me eating my wife's new apple crisp that she just brought me.
Is it good?
Bringing up the chair, David?
But yeah, no, just enough for me.